Hey guys, Marshall and Sagar here.
Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we sat down with one of our nation's leading experts on drug control policy, Hudson's own John Walters. John's career in government stretches from the Reagan administration to his tenure as the director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, otherwise known as the Drug Czar, during the George W. Bush administration.
We explore the debate over the health effects of marijuana, the growing drug legalization movement at the state and the national level, and the connection between the war on drugs and border security. This episode emphasizes one of the realignment's main themes: no policy outcome is inevitable. John emphasizes that policymakers have the ability and the responsibility to make choices rather than to accept the status quo.
Let's dive in.
John Walters, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So you were the drug czar for almost the entirety of the George W. Bush administration. What was your biggest accomplishment?
Well, I think the goals were to reduce drug use, and I'm proud of the fact that we were able to reduce especially teen drug use by 25%. People think, you know, none of these efforts make any difference on drugs. They did. We also helped Colombia go back and become a state that was able to have rule of law, economic growth, by working with then President Uribe, a very brave man who worked with us on destroying the coca industry.
So when you say drug use was down, meth, marijuana, what does drugs constitute?
Well, that number is an aggregate number for all teens, and it goes across all drugs. The biggest single drug, of course, the illegal drug of abuse is marijuana. So that mm-hmm. dropped by 25% or more. But also, we had not only things like meth, which are these tend to be drugs not used by teens as much as they are by young adults or older individuals, but also things like steroid use. That was a big issue at the beginning of the administration because not only the examples from professional baseball that were now public, but also reports that young people, high school students and others, were being encouraged to do this in order to be fully competitive for scholarships and recognition. So President Bush talked about it in the State of the Union and called upon professional sports and baseball, which he had known and been a part of, to clean up their act. They did, more or less.
John, how did you leave things in 2009 when you departed the administration?
While teen drug use had been down, it's still, I believe, going down in most categories. Cocaine production in Colombia had dropped and was continued to drop for a number of years afterwards. And ultimately, use in the United States, for example, as measured by workplace testing, was down 60% in 2010 or so. Meth use, which there was dominated by the kind of Breaking Bad small makers and so forth, using over-the-counter cold and allergy medication, had dropped pretty precipitously. We were working with Mexico. Most of the heroin in the United States that time came from Mexico, and that had been reduced through Mexican efforts to eradicate poppy. There had been some heroin production in Colombia, but that had been eradicated by the Colombians. There was prescription drug abuse, and that had gone up and continued to go up afterwards. But we were working on things like prescription monitoring programs and better monitoring of distribution in the United States during that period, 2006-2007. A famous case by the Justice Department against Purdue Pharma, the OxyContin manufacturer, came to a conclusion with a $600 million fine and a number of executives charged criminally and fined for marketing and the misrepresentation that was done in OxyContin. Mm-hmm.
Something that's interesting is that it's now quite, I don't want to say fashionable, but the opioid crisis is obviously the main frame for people think of drug policy. Where was the conversation on opioids in 2009 at the end of the administration?
Most of what we saw that was dangerous had come with regard to heroin, and we were making some progress. And we hope to make more progress by continuing to work with the Mexican government about drug trafficking and trafficking organizations. Most distribution of drugs was coming up through Mexico and distributed by Mexican-related organizations in the United States. Now, some of those had ties to other ethnic groups in various cities, depending on distribution. But almost all of it had now been concentrated in the movement of drugs across Mexico and across the southwest border.
What does heroin have to do with the opioid crisis, though, right? Weren't opioids just prescriptions?
Well, heroin was always a significant part of opioid misuse. Prescriptions were growing, and they had been a problem and continued to be a problem. There's been a debate about whether or not the abuse of opioids was somehow caused by prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. Actually, they went on simultaneously. There were, if you read a book like Dreamland by
yes.
Sam Quinones, you see he's like talking about two phenomena going on. One is prescription drug diversion and misguided distribution of prescription opioids, but also that there are these groups. He follows one group from Jalisco that were distributing heroin to areas that had not previously been centers of heroin abuse.
Yeah.
They stayed out of the major cities. They went to other areas. They had this little combination of strategies that they used. But look, we were also seeing, we were worried, obviously, about heroin. 95% of the heroin in the world is coming from Afghanistan. We were treating Afghanistan, and I did some work in Afghanistan as drug policy director, but we were seeing it not so much the heroin from there coming to the United States, but that it was funding
the Taliban
and other terrorist groups and leading to instability when we were trying to create stability.
John, it seems to me that the interim 10-year period is so important, obviously, to the discussion right now, which we've seen this explosion in opioid deaths. We've seen a complete change in the national discussion around marijuana. Where and how has the policy landscape changed in the last 10 years since 2009?
Well, first, I would start with the contrast. I mean, we had a misguided, but you had an actual experiment about what policy should be. Because when we tried to create a balanced strategy, funding treatment and prevention, working clearly and strategically on key areas of threat, meth, cocaine, marijuana was even down, and marijuana we thought was a serious threat, which we can talk about why we thought that and why I still think that. But the Obama administration came in, and the first thing they did on drug strategy is declare an end to the drug war. Now, you know, drug war is a kind of jargon that is misused and sometimes confuses people, but it was originally designed to say it's important. It was then by people who didn't like the policies to say that, well, this was war on our own people. It was designed to save people, going back to the Nixon administration, but to raise the priority of paying attention to drugs.
So let's get to that real quick, though, because I think a lot of what's driving a legalization efforts, but also broader changes in the discussion on drug policy is the consensus that the war on drugs failed. Do you think the war on drugs succeeded, or even in the most generous definition of the war on drugs?
I don't think there's another policy area that has shown over the last 20 or 30 years greater response to effective policies and greater decline in the absence of effective policies. In other words, I think the contrary of the war on drugs fails, it succeeds whenever we actually do sensible things, and the drug problem gets worse when we stop. When Obama said, I'm ending the drug war, he said, I'm not going to enforce drug laws as rigorously. They're unjust. They're racist. I'm not going to focus on border security because I think the border is a different problem from what people have thought in the past. I'm not going to take seriously the discussion that drugs are bad for young people. Mm-hmm. He did interviews saying, well, really, you know, I smoke marijuana, I use drugs. It's kind of more of a bad habit. Because of his affinity with young people, he could have had an enormous and cost-free effect on young people's attitudes by just saying, I think drugs are bad for young people. Yes, my generation did it. We lost people. Don't make this mistake. Instead, he downplayed the risk, and we've got an explosion of drug use.
So how did your policy achievement during the Bush administration was a decrease in teen use. Did the lenient policies of the Obama administration lead to an increase in teen use?
Yeah, there's much more use now, and it's harder to measure use because also during the Obama administration, ironically, they took apart and defunded a bunch of programs that measured it. We used to have a program that measured people coming into emergency rooms for substance abuse disorder episodes. That was defunded, the so-called Drug Abuse Warning Network, or DAWN. They used to have a program that funded a Sentinel look at people who were arrested, whether the rates of substance abuse testing positive. That was defunded. And we have an old program now that is just coming out with results that is the largest federal program measuring drug use in self-reported home visits of a representative sample of Americans 12 and above. That showed continuing increases not only in use, but in, for example, with marijuana, with frequent use, which we know is much more dangerous, daily use, use 300 days a year. All that has increased. At the same time, what you saw by the commercialization that legalization has allowed is much more potent forms of these substances available. Leave aside the, you know, we have a kind of parallel to the movement of fentanyl into the opioid problem and its incredible concentration leading to overdose deaths and more overdoses. But also in the marijuana side, we have the creation of versions of marijuana with THC, the psychoactive ingredient, that are many times more concentrated. Now, people like to say, you know, 3 milligrams in the joints of the Woodstock generation per joint. I have talked to emergency room physicians in Pueblo, Colorado, a woman that testified with me in New England. She is now seeing people with psychological breakdown coming into the emergency room who are consuming 2,500 milligrams a day.
That's astounding. And I think, John, one of the main questions here is there has been an effort, and there's a growing consensus, especially amongst the younger generation, that talk like this about marijuana leading to mental breakdown is just a rehash of Reefer Madness, which was a famous film, I think, from the 1930s, 1940s period, which depicted young people losing their minds. And they say this is an obvious propagandistic effort. How are you reconciling that whenever we look at the mental health effects of marijuana, especially in higher THC doses?
Yeah, look, the source of all this is partly, I think, my generation. I'm a baby boomer. And their experimentation with drugs. Drugs was part of kind of the youth revolution. It was part of a cultural change that many people, even though they're getting old in the tooth here, I want to remember their young time of exciting youthful exuberance, and smoking marijuana was a part of that. Never mind the fact that they kind of had experiences where people got their lives off track, and some of them seriously off track. Never mind the fact that things have changed, and the amount of use and the effect on young people has changed. Never mind the fact that the science has shown us this is much more dangerous for young people, especially in the concentrations you see today. So they have these fond memories. That's woven into our culture. I used to run a youth anti-drug media campaign when I was a drug policy director. $100 million a year, 2 units of time and space for everyone that we bought. We had a big footprint, as big as Pizza Hut at that time. And we were talking about marijuana and other drugs. We did the first ads about prescription drug abuse that was designed to help keep pills away from kids. That campaign was defunded by Obama, but that campaign allowed us to kind of present what was really going on in the science. That campaign also surveyed what exposure young people got from consultants who market to young people. They kept journals every 2 weeks. Every time you hear drugs, what do you hear? Well, it was consistent. We did that over the course of every year. It was consistently on an average of 12 to 1, use drugs, everybody uses drugs, versus what parents or adults think they're telling young people. There's are dangers, there's, you should be careful. So what I'm saying is, when you say drug education, our culture does educate young people. It encourages them to use drugs or to minimize the dangers of using drugs. So it's not surprising we have more people using it. When you then spread these substances around, commercial enterprises, stores, phony view arguments about, oh, it's proven to be medicine, which it never has been proven to be medicine, and there is a medical version of synthetic THC that is available, but that doesn't count. So when you do that and lead young people into substance abuse, you have to face the fact that you either believe in the science or you don't. The science says this has severely dangerous consequences in its current form today.
I think what you're saying speaks to why we actually wanted to have you on our show, because obviously the realignment is talking about a really wide variety of policy issues. But I think what's most encouraging so far is your notion that our society, our government, can make a choice as to these policy outcomes. And I think too often you hear people act as if these are sort of forces that can't be dealt with, or we sort of have to sort of sit back and watch certain outcomes come about. So I just wanted to say I really appreciate what you've been saying on that point. And that also gets us then to the issue of the opioid crisis today. So the Trump administration has been focused on this issue for the past 2 years. How would you assess the efforts since this issue took such a prominent place on the national stage?
Well, first, I think it's important to say what President Trump inherited was the worst and most devastating drug epidemic, I think, in the history of the United States. When you talk about 70,000 people dying a year, it was increasing by almost 20% a year. Overdose deaths across the board, dominated by opioids. We've never seen anything like this. Secondly, I would say you cannot get a problem of this magnitude, my view of government generally, without what I would call, these are not the kinds of things where agencies of government or society can simply be given a little bit more money and do a better job. Or for a federal agency, you can kind of, you know, let's give them a little more authority in their authorizing legislation and give them more power to help out here. This is catastrophic failure. This is, and I want to say what agencies I think that involves. First and foremost, First and foremost, it involves the Centers for Disease Control, which doesn't treat this as a disease. Its only report is a one-year-old report of how many people died last year. That's like trying to handle an actual raging epidemic by visiting cemeteries. It's not real time. They don't do that when it comes to Ebola or measles or anything else. They do real-time reporting. CDC does not believe the drug epidemic is an epidemic. That is intolerable. So we don't have, we can't see where the hot spots are. We can't see where things are working or not working.
What's the thinking behind that? There has to be some sort of bureaucratic justification.
They think drugs isn't really a disease. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the science and the agencies that we trust to have scientific and public trust, scientific integrity and public trust, and they don't have it. But another agency that's also catastrophically failed is the federal is the FDA. The FDA not only failed with regard to opioid medications when they were shown to be dangerous. I worked with the FDA commissioner and tried to get them to go back and do more warning, more training. And their argument was our legislation is if a medication is safe and effective, we're used as directed, that's the limit of our regulatory authority. And I said, well, obviously, this substance, when used as directed, has additional dangers. It's not like a statin to reduce your cholesterol. And they didn't want to hear it. They still have not faced up to the consequences of this in regard to marijuana that's being marketed as medicine. If these institutions are supposed to protect us from phony medical claims, they're supposed to protect us from epidemics by guiding us and helping us form policy, they've utterly failed. Obviously, the other thing that's failed is the DEA. They are the agency that's supposed to protect us from these substances. They're out of control. The other thing I would say is we have a failure of border security. Most drugs that are killing Americans come from outside the United States. Most of those come across the southwest border, and most of those pass within 6 feet of a uniformed federal agent. That is a monumental failure of intelligence and operations. So our intelligence agencies, our homeland security agencies, I'm someone who's defended President Trump's call for a wall. It will help us focus people at ports of entry and not have them involved in guard duty between the ports of entry. But these are catastrophic failures. Now, we have not turned this around. But the problem in turning it around is you have to really change agencies. Mm-hmm. You really have to hold people accountable on a scale that they're not being held accountable now. And it's not just money. It's they're going to have to be more effective. You know, the intelligence agencies, beginning with CIA and the Director of National Intelligence, are going to have to make 70,000 deaths the priority it should be. What other terrorist organization is going to kill 70,000 Americans this year? None. And I'm not saying I'm against the amount of money we're spending on terror. I live in Washington, D.C. It's the bullseye. So I don't want anybody pulling our guard down. But the fact is, we are not spending and using our resources commensurate with the threat. And that gets into the moral issue of we have a different attitude toward the victims of overdoses and drug abuse than we have toward the people, for example, who died in 9/11.
Mm. So this goes to an interesting discussion which hampers, I think, the sort of efforts to address this on a bipartisan issue. How do you respond to the often the critique given by the left that during the 1980s, when the African-American community was undergoing a crack epidemic, it was treated as this unsympathetic area. And now that this is perceived with the opioid crisis as an issue affecting white working class persons, it's much more sympathetic.
Is there validity to the claim? You were working in the Reagan administration and you worked in the Bush administration.
I think there was more energy and focus of national attention and, frankly, effort against the crack epidemic. Now, I recognize that some of the focus has now been criticized for the results of extra policing, for example, in African-American or center city communities created arrests and incarceration rates that are not seen as problematic. Yes. But again, I'm old enough to actually have been there when, you know, Charlie Rangel and Joe Biden and Pat Leahy sponsored crack mandatory minimums, because the goal was to take the people, no matter what their color, who are preying on less fortunate, disadvantaged inner city neighborhoods and destroying them and punish them harshly and break and destroy their capacity to continue that harm. Now, it did work to some degrees. I mean, I was involved in some of the funding for organ task forces that helped to clean up. I worked in Washington, D.C. when there were over 400 murders a year. Now, there's still too many murders in Washington, D.C., but it's not even a third of that. And when New York City was at over 1,200 murders a year. So, you know, some of the arguments here about we have arguments about policy that are not about the empirical reality now. Mm-hmm. We have arguments about policy that are very dangerous because they're detached from looking at the real problem and what the real contours of that problem are, what's really happened over time when policies have been used or not. And it's more and more a priori. Because I believe the world must work this way, all policies must be designed consistently.
Well, you're talking to a very, very real theme of the realignment here, which is reexamining policy decisions, like thinking that, you know, that normalizing trade relations with China would lead to a win-win situation, that going back and reexamining and taking off blinders. What do you think has enabled these blinders to last for so long within the bureaucracy, especially when you're talking about the FDA and the CDC and many of these other government organizations charged with protecting American consumers?
Well, in the case of most recently, I think the failure during the Obama administration to continue the pressure, and in fact the malicious effort, in my judgment, to dismantle the structures that should be protecting Americans. I don't want to focus on drugs. I don't want to focus on crime. I don't want to focus on problems in Latin America. I don't want the CDC talking about the increase in drug use, which was happening on their watch. They just stopped reporting some of these measures and took apart the instruments that we had to know this. So part of this is not just an accident or a cultural change. And people want to talk about cultural change like it's the weather. Ironically, now we think we should control the weather, but we think we're all victims of cultural change. that people don't make the society they live in. They have self-determination. And I think what's happened with some of these problems is the view that that people in these matters should not be talking about what's good and bad for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the converse, you mentioned self-determination. We see a growing legalization by state-by-state level effort in this country. There is a broad consensus, often voter-driven consensus, that they want to legalize marijuana on the state level. How do you think that – what are the consequences of those decisions? What have we learned from those efforts?
It's been running this experiment for several years now, of course.
Yeah, but I think it's also important, the consequences I'll get to, but how this came about. You know, when I started in the 80s and 90s, you had Normal was around. They were a bunch of, you know.
What was Normal?
National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws. Uh-huh. And they were fringe. They weren't a serious matter. What changed all that was George Soros, John Lewis, and Peter Lewis and John Sperling, three billionaires, joined forces to change marijuana legislation. And they bought millions of dollars worth of ads. They paid people to sign petitions in states to get on the ballot to legalize marijuana, first as medicine, falsely, and then as a recreational substance.
You've said that several times. What do you mean by falsely as medicine?
Well, we have the most sophisticated medical care system in the history of human beings in the United States. It's based on science. We have requirements that when people market a medication, they show that it's safe and effective through rigorous examination with scientific standards. Marijuana is now sold as the only substance that can't meet those requirements. Marijuana has to be voted on in a plebiscite to show that it's good. And it hasn't. And it has negative consequences. We know it has negative consequences. Even the naive knew it has problems with impairing judgment, impairing motor skills, impairing concentration. There's no, almost any state that sells this now, there's no warning label. There's no, and now we know there's other things, including marijuana-induced psychosis, tendency toward violence. Now, that actually has been known for a long time. Alex Berenson
yes.
has his famous book, Tell Your Children, that's gotten a fair amount of attention. It deserves more attention. It documents this. The people who are in the marijuana industry hate this book and hate what it says, but they're wrong, and he's right. And what you're seeing in Colorado and other places when you get to consequences is much greater use, much greater harm, much greater unraveling of social fabric. I went to Colorado shortly after they legalized for recreational purposes and met with people in the community at some of the people I knew's request. And one woman there was telling me, my children, because of marijuana, candies, concentrates, juices, and everything else, my children now go to a school in my community. They cannot bring anything to eat or drink to the school for fear that it'll be contaminated and be given to other children. Anything they eat or drink in the school must be under school control from the beginning.
Here's what's so frustrating about everything you're saying. We just got through a 50-year struggle against big tobacco, but now our society seems completely fine with the creation of big marijuana. They have, you referenced it, candy marijuana products. There's CBD, other sort of derivatives.
Lollipops, soda with THC. Endless, you know, amount of children that are using vape products, which they don't necessarily understand how much they're consuming. All of this is happening. What is it that we can do to stop the emergence of another big marijuana, so to speak?
Well, we need some political leadership. I mean, look, the science is the same. The science has shown this is a problem, the vaping industry. Now, okay, now it's being sold as this is safer for you than cigarettes, so you should be able to use it. Now, why do we need millions of people addicted to nicotine? How is that good for America?
Wasn't it a good substitute? Well, Juuls don't kill people.
Well, but
let's get to this too. The argument is always alcohol kills 15,000 people a year. It's just as dangerous. If it's legal, why can't marijuana?
Actually, they would say it's way more dangerous. Yeah. Not just as dangerous.
I like to put that in the category of what I call the lowest form of moral argument. Two wrongs make a right. You know. So we've had a difficult history with alcohol. No question about it. No less a person though than Abraham Lincoln spoke to a temperance society about alcohol and the dangers of alcohol. It got so bad, we actually tried to ban it. Why did we reverse that? And that ban reduced consumption dramatically per capita, within our ability to estimate this. Per capita alcohol consumption did not return to the pre-prohibition levels until like the 1970s. Why? Because these are addictive behaviors. Large quantities have to be consumed. They're consumed by people who are hooked. Alcohol prohibition removed, by every measure, all the health consequences that were measurable with regard to alcohol and alcoholism. So it worked. What it didn't do is it prohibited production. It didn't do anything about consumption. And at the end of it, Americans wanted to consume alcohol. We have a long history with that. It's a problematic history. Nobody would deny that when you see what happens with family violence and individuals. Most people I know, including my family, have had history of alcoholism in their family. They know up close and personal what it does. Now, we have decided to tolerate that harm. But that doesn't mean you should tolerate all harms because you don't have a long historical consequence. And also, these substances we have certainly plentiful evidence they're more harmful for you.
Really? Why? How is marijuana more harmful to me than alcohol? As a standard user or sort of a worst case scenario?
Or are you talking societally, like on an aggregate basis?
Well, first of all, standard user and dependent user are not fixed lines. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody starts out by saying, you know, I see that guy who's an alcoholic passed out on the street. I want to be like him. They start drinking and don't expect to be there. I've spent a lot of time with people in treatment. Nobody starts using any of these substances expecting to be addicted. They expect they're not going to be addicted. And the pernicious part of these substances, if anybody has had this experience in their family, which most people have, it changes who they are. Uncle Joe is not Uncle Joe anymore when he's high, when he's addicted, when he's drunk. And he comes to Thanksgiving dinner and he becomes not Uncle Joe. He becomes this ugly person. So these take away your sense of yourself. They take away judgment. They impair through craving your ability to control your own need. Marijuana is like that. And marijuana increasingly, and especially in the concentrations that are available today, are more and more subject to making you incapable of controlling your own life. That your life, all these forms of addiction that we measure for admitting people to treatment, the characteristics that they assess is how much of your life is collapsing into essentially seeking and using the drug. So you can't relate to other people, or you relate to them destructively. You can't hold a job. You can't study. You can't focus. You can't carry your responsibilities. So all of these substances have that in common. And the more concentrated it is with marijuana, yes, marijuana is not toxic in the sense of heroin or cocaine. But make no mistake, marijuana is the single largest cause and has been for decades of treatment need in the United States. When I was in office, 75% of our treatment need, that is the people who surveys indicate need treatment, are marijuana dependent. And most people across all these dependencies, the problem with fixing this is a characteristic of all these dependencies, alcohol, even cigarettes, but certainly drugs, is denial that I need help. Mm-hmm. The surveys show that the same people who show the characteristics of needing treatment, 95% of them, don't believe they need treatment and don't seek it. So you can't just say, well, we need to build more treatment capacity. People won't come. Mm-hmm.
This goes to a real question about prohibition, is how do you stop people from consuming marijuana? Is making it illegal the best way to do it? And then how do we also deal with what Marshall talked about, the criminal justice and racial implications of that?
And to add on to that real quick, it seems to me that in the legalization community, they will often cite the example of countries such as Portugal,
right,
who have decriminalized, quasi-legalized drugs and have claimed they've had better outcomes for society and the addicts themselves.
Yeah, well, when I was in office, the cartoon opposites were the Netherlands and the United States. The Netherlands, anything goes. They have coffee shops. They sell cannabis and hashish, and we are tough and enforcer. I worked extensively with the Dutch health and justice minister because they were trying to close those down. 90% of the Dutch communities had closed down coffee shops. Why? Because they had found that, especially with increased concentrations of cannabis products, they were having difficulty, psychological problems, greater rates of addiction. It was bringing in people who were using cocaine, heroin, ecstasy, and other things. Because there's a characteristic now in developed countries, especially, of polydrug use, going from one thing to another.
So the gateway drug argument.
Well, yeah, but people, the gateway drug argument is true. The problem is it's been laughed at by people. They say, well, this is like Reefer Madness. They talk
a lot
about
of
gateway.
This has been caricatured.
Yeah, and it continues to be now by billions of dollars in this industry. So the first thing I would recommend doing now is let's sue the producers. Mm-hmm. They're no longer, you know, Joe Schmo dealer on the side you can't find. Big corporations and big venture capital firms are investing in big marijuana. So there are deep pockets. And there is known harms that have been known for decades that they have to fly in the face of. And there are certainly a legion of people who are already having their lives wrecked and can be brought to bear as claimants on the harm that's been done knowingly by these corporations. So let's stop the expansion. Secondly, let's focus on not expanding this, and let's get the information out. Again, one of the things that President Obama did is he silenced the people who have the evidence here. We need to get the evidence about what's going on in Colorado and other places out. And what you're seeing is devastation. And what you're seeing is the growth, not just of marijuana addiction, but movement toward opioids through cocaine because of polydrug use. It's not true that originally there was a story put out that, well, where there's medical marijuana, there's less opioid overdoses. It's completely the reverse. But now nobody checks that because, as Alex Berenson has pointed out, one of the big problems here is the media and the press have not been diligent and have knowingly misrepresented the realities that we know about these
things. So, John, you mentioned something very important here. You talked about the emergence of a large-scale, multi-dollar marijuana industry. You talked a little bit about this in your event with Senator John Cornyn, about whether that these companies, which currently because marijuana is illegal on a federal level, they don't have access to the banking system, they have large amounts of cash, and they have been proposing access to the legal banking system. Let's take a listen to that exchange.
One of the other things that's going to affect, I think, the domestic expansion of marijuana and maybe other things is proposals to change the banking law to allow some of these proceeds to go into the banking system where they are not freely able to enter now. What do you think the prospect of that is?
Well, I was talking to Senator Crapo, the chairman of the banking committee, I think it was yesterday, about that. I believe they've had some testimony where right now, because of the federal law, you can't use the banking system for the proceeds of legal, otherwise, I put in quotes, legal marijuana sales in places like Colorado and elsewhere. So there's huge cash, and obviously the danger of that from corruption standpoint or from a public safety standpoint, that's a real threat. So they're actually beginning to explore whether there ought to be some sort of carve out or some sort of accommodation made where the proceeds of this, quote, legal business at the state level can somehow enter the banking system. And that's, he was expressing to me that that's no easy task. And I had mentioned to him that I think, well, even before we start to do that, let's have this hearing on the public safety consequences so people can go into this with their eyes open.
Huge introduction of cash. It'll be moved to political power. I mean, that's the other threat here, is that now it's the entry of these forces into the legitimate political process through these businesses. It's
good
billions
point.
Of dollars, yeah.
John, there you mentioned that granting the marijuana industry cash, basically their ability to access the legal banking system, will increase their political power. What would that look like, in your opinion? Because there's a lot of growing calls for that right now within Congress.
Well, once the money can be safely secreted into the legitimate banking system, then it can be used for everything from political contributions to other kinds of lobbying and other kinds of promotion of that industry. Right now, they have some restrictions on that. But the other thing it allows that we know from Colorado is there's no clear way of determining legal marijuana and drug money from illegal marijuana and drug money. So it allows the commingling, which is exactly why groups have gone into places like Colorado, the criminal groups, because there is a reduction of risk. Enforcement has been suppressed, so there can be a freer use of all these criminal activities by these groups. Not to mention, they're not only not facing law enforcement, but they can then more effectively use their own violence and subversion to get what they don't get through regular action.
And this contradicts one of the original narratives around legalization, which was that legalization, which paired with hard enforcement against illegal traffickers, will ultimately squeeze out the illegal market and make it so that the state has a monopoly of control.
Is that and
not,
tax revenue.
And tax revenue. That not something that we've seen
in
these
states? A series of big lies in that. In most of the places where there's been legalization, the legalization outlets have now complained that there needs to be more enforcement. There's too many criminal groups going on here, which is exactly the reverse of what they promised. Secondly, the claim was that they're gonna have all kinds of a boon to tax revenue. That's simply not materialized. In fact, when I talk to law enforcement from these areas that I used to work with, they're telling me they don't think these people are paying their taxes. One of the first things I think the federal government should do is do a tax audit on all these places, because I think what they're going to find is, and now they know because they're in a corporate documents who the bosses are, now there's tax fraud going on. I don't conduct these investigations, but I'm telling you what they're telling me is they don't believe there's adequate tax revenue being generated given the revenues they're seeing in these businesses.
What I don't understand is, why can we not as a society say, look, we can accept the idea that there were disproportionate harms on communities that engaged in drug use during the 70s, 80s, and 90s, while also saying drugs aren't great, let's not legalize them further. Like, what's preventing us from just coming to a third-way position on that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that back, because I want to get back to the issue of disadvantaged communities and the mm-hmm. racism argument. One of the things that you have to do when you had my job is you got to talk to people who are on the front line. I spent a lot of time in communities of color. I spent time with Elijah Cummings in his district right after I was confirmed. He asked me to come out, and I did that as a first thing. And I asked him to walk around his district with me afterwards, which showed how terrible the situation was in these communities. I've sat in community meetings with mothers who I sat in one during Bush 41 when I was a deputy in the office with Bill Bennett in Southeast, where a mother stood up, much to the chagrin of some of the elites, and said, you know, why don't you shoot these drug dealers? And everybody said, oh. And she said, you would do it if it was your neighborhood and your kids had to walk to school past open-air drug markets with drug dealers. And it's true. I live in Chevy Chase, D.C. That area would not tolerate open-air drug markets. So what happens in these communities is the same thing that happens in areas of education and healthcare, public safety. They get inadequate public services, and there isn't a voice making those things happen. I think one of the great things about what you're trying to do is to make people reconsider public policy.
There's no trying here. We've done it. We've solved it, okay?
I mean, in so many of these areas, not just where people say, well, we don't really have healthcare solved, but people have stopped talking about education. We still have public schools failing at with dropout rates at 50% in major cities in the United States. What do we think these young people are going to happen? They're not educated. They can't get jobs. What happens to their lives and their families' lives? So what's happening here is I think there's a strong argument for what has been made, the arguments made before, which is the real racism is that the communities of color, the communities of disadvantage in this country, even rural ones, simply are forgotten. Mm-hmm. And the people who advocate this live in places that are protected and safe, and they have gates, and they have whatever protection they want, because they're not going to tolerate being unsafe. But then they're sentencing other people to lives and communities of disadvantage, of underinvestment, because businesses don't come because it's a war zone, because schools don't work, because families can't work, because then we want to say, well, when we remove criminals from the streets of these communities, it's not to make people safer, it's to harm them, because their identity is the identity of the person doing violence. And that's just completely wrongheaded, and really seals a cycle of abandonment for people in disadvantaged communities, and people who now are left to say, harm is not harm in your world.
Mm-hmm. Well, extremely well said. And what it does come to is the central idea, like we said from the beginning, we have a choice in this matter, is that there is not a helplessness within our society. And yet, one of the major themes on this podcast is about the atomization of the individual. John, as somebody who works on the law enforcement side, how do we look at the addict itself? Like, how do we look at, or the atom themselves, and how they got into that situation? How did you approach that when you were thinking about criminal justice, or the criminal justice aspect of enforcement? How should we think about that going forward?
We spent a lot of time on trying to create what we called a balance strategy, trying to help with prevention. I mentioned we had an ad campaign we worked on for teens, but we also did things in workplace. We supported things like random testing, which the federal government had supported in security and transportation, but also in a wider way as a prevention issue, not as a gotcha issue. We spent a lot of money. I don't think you'll meet anybody living who's argued more and more successfully for federal treatment money, for focusing treatment, for making treatment accountable to aftercare and other programs related to treatment. But we have to accept that, as I said earlier, the overwhelming message that people get in our society is that drug use is okay, it's safe, or those who say it's not safe are making overblown claims. So people get trapped, and not trapped because they're stupid. It's trapped because they're told a distorted view of what the reality is, and the substances themselves are seductive, as we know. People don't realize they're being addicted. That's a problem for a free society. These substances require a different kind of category from just saying as an independent person, you're responsible. You take these, you're responsible for the consequences. All of a sudden, your ability to be responsible for yourself is compromised. That's very hard for libertarians to appreciate and understand, even though they kind of have had experiences like this. But it goes against the fundamental quasi-religious doctrines that they subscribe to. That requires us to reach some kind of better understanding if we're going to have a. But other part of this that I'd say I've thought about and changed my mind about in regard to the magnitude of the opioid problem and the overdose deaths is this is really about supply. This is more properly understood as a mass poisoning, something that society has to work to stop. And that requires government action and not just telling individuals not to take these drugs. And that requires us to stop the flow. Now, what you usually get here is, oh, how can we possibly stop the flow of drugs? People want them and they're there and everything else. And my argument is that really is a lazy response to this problem. Take terrorism as an example. After 9/11, we knew this was a needle in the haystack problem. A few people, maybe with nothing, just stealing airplanes, maybe with small amounts of something like anthrax, could kill millions of Americans potentially. We had to stop that. And that was a very difficult problem. And it still is a difficult problem. But every day I would argue we don't have an attack. We solve that problem as a society and as a government. Drugs is not a needle in the haystack problem. It requires hundreds of metric tons, hundreds of tons of money, thousands of people. We can make that smaller. That's a pickup truck in a haystack. We can find it, and we can bang on it, and we can hurt it. It's a network problem, but we're not. As I said earlier, we're not even focused with the resources necessary to demand that institutions mm-hmm. work.
Well, you mentioned a supply problem. One of the major issues is that fentanyl-tainted heroin is one of the things that is the major killers of Americans right now at this moment. Much of that fentanyl that's been discovered comes from China. Now, you've talked about at that event with Senator Cornyn that we mentioned about how you believe that the Chinese don't wake up and they don't wish goodwill upon the Americans and possibly even harm. Do you think that there was an intentionality behind that fentanyl support and that the amount of supply that was entering our country and eventually killing our citizens?
I don't believe that they necessarily, the government of China, started out by making heroin and shipping to the United States. I just believe that once it started, they don't have an incentive to stop it. I dealt with the Chinese with regard to meth precursors that were then that time being sent into Mexico. And we tried to get their cooperation. And they were very difficult to work with. And then when you finally got enough pressure, public pressure or embarrassment, what they would do, the typical thing they would do is say, oh yeah, we caught that guy last week and he had a friend and we shot him. There, it's all over. Which is just not the way any of this works. But we have a very clear measure on whether, China is a police state, right? Now, it's not perfect, it's big, but it's basically a police state. It could stop this if it wanted to in a very short period of time. And we know whether they stop it, because if they stop it, the deaths stop. Because of
it's that well correlated.
Yeah. Some of it's being shipped directly to the United States through the mails, we still know, but a lot of it's coming up through Mexico, sometimes through precursors being cooked in Mexico, but sometimes directly finished fentanyl. If they stop, the deaths stop. If the deaths don't stop, they're continuing to do it. Now, the other reason that, aside from they don't really care if the United States is harmed, in fact, as a rival superpower, if we're unraveling our social fabric, that's good for them mm-hmm. nationally, and they're not gentlemen about this. But the other thing is, what I found in countries that have this problem is it always involves corruption, because big money, these kinds of illegal activities, in order to reduce risk, organizations corrupt people who have enforcement authority. So it's embarrassing to get on top of the problem, because you're going to find some of your officials, sometimes at a high level, are compromised. So that's another reason why, it's for selfish reasons, they don't care. And they always try to tell themselves, well, it's your demand that's causing the problem, not our supply. It's their supply. You don't need to get the point. I think it's time, and President Trump has started to do this, to say you do not get to poison Americans and get away with it. It stops. Now, we have many issues to deal with regard to China, North Korea, we want their help on, and other kinds of things, strategic rival. So I understand that this is not an easy one-issue approach to China. On the other hand, we have a lot of leverage on China. We have a lot of leverage with regard to international parcel post. We give them a cut rate. We let them come in. We let them send stuff in that in quantities we can't possibly check every package. They don't send shipper information, so we can use databases to target things that are high risk. We could just say no more high rate and everything's got to be digital. Now, that'll cause disruption. You can threaten to do it in 6 months if you want or something else, but you can increase the cost of what they care about in a proportional sector here that allows them to feel a need to change. Mm-hmm. But right now, there is no excuse, I believe, for continuing to allow Americans to die in the numbers they're dying without a more forceful response.
So you praise Senator Cornyn's efforts to have multifaceted strategy to take on the opioid crisis at that event here at Hudson. Let's take a listen to how he describes his Narcos initiative.
The real kicker here is that in the face of all this violence and trauma, the organizations fueling the crisis are becoming richer and richer by the moment. The instability throughout Central America and Mexico is near a breaking point. Frustrations are running high, and as we hear in Washington from time to time, people say, well, something's got to happen, something. Well, my hope is that something will be constructive and avoid unintended consequences born out of frustration. Congress, of course, has an important responsibility and an opportunity to make a meaningful contribution to stabilizing the region, and the time to act is, well, it was yesterday. This Congress, I was selected to co-chair of the Senate International Caucus on Narcotics Control, where we've been examining some of the opportunities to stop narcotics trafficking and fight drug abuse throughout the country. Today, what I'd like to do is to discuss my proposal to attack this problem from multiple angles, something we call the New America's Recommitment to Counter Narcotics Operations and Strategy Initiative. Everybody in Washington loves an acronym, and of course the acronym is NARCOS. Addressing the security challenges throughout Mexico and Central America will require bipartisan commitment to long-term solutions. Nothing happens in this town without bipartisan support. That's just the way it is. Addressing the security challenges throughout Mexico and Central America will require leadership and willing partners. As we learn from our own mixed record on nation building in the Middle East, you can't want something for someone more than they want it for themselves. So we must lay a foundation for a stronger region and a stronger America, and that's precisely what we would propose to do under the NARCOS initiative. First, we would take aim at the dangerous poisons coming across the southern border. Our country's opioid crisis began as a result of overprescription of drugs, but we've cracked down on the prescription drugs, and so demands for those sold by cartels and criminal organizations have increased. And as we know, if one form of opioid isn't available, well, the cheaper opioid known as heroin and fentanyl are more readily available at a lower price. So stopping these substances isn't simple as putting up signs at the port of entry. Transnational criminal organizations and the drug cartels will stop at nothing to exploit Americans who are addicted to the narcotics that are tearing families and communities apart.
John, what is it about Senator Cornyn's Narcos initiative that you find most praiseworthy? And why do you think it's going to be, or why, if enacted, it could be effective?
Well, first of all, I think it steps up in multiple domains pressure on this problem. But secondly, I think it brings Congress together to focus seriously on this. One of the problems is I think the absence of information has made it even hard for Congress to get a grasp. I went to the signing ceremony for the opioid bill that was passed about a year ago because of my past job. And, it was a bipartisan effort, $6 billion, $3 billion a year over 2 years. Certainly, given the harm done to the United States, no one wanted to say, well, we don't need more resources. However, we're so ignorant that you can't even know, is $3 billion a year enough? Where are you going to deploy it? Where's, you got more treatment resources. Where's the treatment need most? We do not have the equivalent of a heat map of where the concentrations are. These are not evenly distributed throughout the United States, although the problem is in most states, in some places, much worse than others. But we do, this is, if it's an epidemic, you need to put the countermeasures on the problem. This is like trying to fight a fire in a city by spraying water all over the city, which is what the government was doing because it doesn't have more precise information. But that, by definition, cannot work. You need to be able to focus. You need a strategy that focuses on the taxonomy of the problem, finds critical nodes, takes them apart, targets them especially. Some of you are going to do that, learn that by trial and error. But without that kind of information, without those kind, we can't even scale resources, let alone tell whether efforts are going to work. That's how far out of the game we are. And that's why we're losing tens of thousands of people a year.
To finish this up, it seems to me if there's one unifying theme throughout this discussion, it's that drug policy is rarely literally about drug policy. It's about bigger, deeper things. And we're debating the crime bill. We're debating race in America. If we're debating the rural versus urban dynamics of the opioid crisis, it's really about class. How do you think, and what would you suggest we do to move beyond narrative and actually engage with the specifics on the ground?
Well, first of all, I think that we have to rebuild a consensus, so we need basic information. That's why I focused on things like the CDC should report where this is each day. I was in the Reagan administration when they reported on HIV and AIDS, and that was a huge, they had a morbidity and mortality weekly report, which they still publish, that focused on new cases every time. Why aren't we reporting where treatment admissions are? Why aren't we reporting emergency room cases? Why aren't we reporting EMT calls for overdoses that are non-fatal? The biggest predictor of a fatal overdose is a previous non-fatal overdose. So why aren't we collecting that information in real time? Why aren't we collecting real-time information on the seizures of these quantities? Why aren't we holding local people accountable? We should be able to map this and say you need more of both enforcement and treatment or prevention resources in different areas. So without that information, we can't educate people to what this problem looks like. It's kind of everywhere and nowhere. Mm-hmm. It's everybody's responsibility. It's nobody's responsibility. It needs to be focused. And that's a basic public education part of politics and political debate. Secondly, we need then to hold institutions accountable using that information. Why aren't our borders being better protected against these poisons? Why aren't we able to seize at the ports of entry? It's not true they can hide everywhere all the time. We do a job on terror. We ought to expect that job to be done on the terrorists who are using drugs to kill Americans, which is what this really is. In addition, we ought to look at our foreign policy. What are we doing with these countries? Colombia is now producing more cocaine than ever before. What are we doing? We had a plan Colombia. It worked. What are we doing with regard to working with them and holding them accountable for what's happening? What are we doing with regard to Mexico? We have relationships in this country with a variety of foreign governments that are involved in money laundering. I hear increasingly that China is involved as becoming a center for money laundering. What are we doing about that? Just kind of, we've stopped informing the American people. It's not that they don't care, and it's not that they're all listening to something else and they're not paying attention. We've stopped telling them what's going on with regard to the dangers we know from marijuana, the dangers that we see from opioids, the dangers that we see from a growing and expanding heroin production in the Obama administration in Mexico. So it's not surprising that people have said, well, maybe we should just legalize drugs because we can't do anything. It's not that we can't do anything, and it's not that we don't know things. It's that we've stopped making that knowledge salient.
Well, as you said, we have a choice. So John Walters, thank you so much for joining the Realignment. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. As always, please rate us 5 stars and subscribe to The Realignment wherever you listen to your podcasts.
As we mentioned in the episode, John recently hosted Senator Cornyn at Hudson to discuss his work on combating transnational crime. Go to hudson.org to check out the video and transcript of that discussion and to learn more about John's work. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.